Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the NIDS View, and this is, of course, part two of our discussion of Keith Payne's article, Deterrence and Arms Control, Ending the Deceptive Holiday from History. And we had gone through four of his false claims, you know, from this period from 1991 to the present. And we were discussing those, and we got to number four, and we ran out of time, so we said, we're going to do episode number two.
I would couch miss idealist fallacies.
Idealist fallacies. You know, that's a great way to put it. So let's jump back into this discussion. I'm sure you, the listeners, have listened to number one podcast, you know, the first
the prior week.
Yes, yeah.
And if you haven't, please do so.
Yes, stop. Put us on stop right here. Go listen to that. Then come back to this one. Okay. So fallacy number five says U.S. actions incite opponents' arms buildup, not their own malign goals. Thus, U.S. armaments supposedly are the cause of arms racing. If the United States stops, so will opponents. This action-reaction dynamic is an iron law of international relations that explains arms racing. Correspondingly, U.S. inaction will lead to opponents' inaction. Washington can be the example of good behavior to the world and preclude arms races by not inciting them. This is a really important, you know, idealist fallacy. And, you know, Curtis, I'll let you tackle this one first.
So I love this argument that arms racing is always driven by American behavior, even when we do nothing. Putin recently, President Putin recently, I think maybe a week or two ago, said that Russia was now at the 95% modernization of his nuclear forces. And we still are, there's no new metal on the runways or in the silos or at sea. And yet, many of the idealist arms control proponents in their community will try to tell the American people and the rest of the world that they are doing this because of our modernization schedule. And I would argue that maybe we're doing it because of theirs. We're still way behind in that regard. I wanted to point out in the arms racing models, there are three arms racing models for our students. There's the spiral model, which is the one that everybody's probably most familiar with, which is that arms racing tit for tat sort of thing, what we refer to as the action reaction paradigm. And then take it from the action is US, the reaction is someone else. Right. So the idea is every time we do something that might be for self-protection or otherwise, that it's somehow menacing to the others, and that they don't ever do anything of their own volition or in their own national interest. They only react to what we do. That's sort of the idea in this. The second one, also mentioned here in Keith's writing, is what we can refer to as the restraint model, or inaction, which is this idea that if we don't do anything, Adam, the adversary won't do anything either. And this is fundamentally flawed because it's never borne out, right? The idea that they will always follow if we do something weakness unilaterally, that they will follow along. I think we've got a lot of history that says that doesn't happen, right?
Isn't this, you know, wasn't it Harold Brown or Schlesinger?
Yes,
one of the
Harold Brown.
Who said, we build, they build, we stop, they build.
Right, well, we don't build, they build. Yes, absolutely. And that was in the 1970s for our listeners. We knew that to be the case. There's a third model, right? And that is what I refer to as the action-inaction paradigm, or the Western model. And this is when one state, us, accommodates others by doing nothing in the hopes of de-escalating. It is a formal version of the ostrich syndrome, where we stick our heads in the sand and say, we're going to pretend that your nuclear buildup is not destabilizing. And we're just going to not do anything about it because we don't want to. And we're going to hope, which is not a strategy, but we are going to hope that you will somehow see the light and stop doing what you're doing. And so that is sort of the Western model, as I absurdly call it out here, in that when an aggressor tries to seek a change in the status quo, we fail to respond in the hopes of maintaining the status quo. And that in itself is troublesome.
And but it doesn't this sort of go back to a more fundamental tenet that we tell our children or that we, you know, tell each other, and that is, you know, stupid is doing the same thing and expecting different results.
Insanity, right? That's the definition of insanity.
Yeah. So,
which is what I think this whole argument, this whole article that Dr. Payne wrote is really about, right? Is sort of this, we have to stop this insanity and do something different.
Yeah. Okay. So how about number six? And Jim, I'll ask you to respond first. And so Keith says, and this is, remember, fallacy number six, the lower the number of nuclear weapons, the lower the prospects for nuclear war, accidents, and societal damage. So reductions, by definition, are an unalloyed good virtually regardless of an agreement's details regarding arms. Jim, your thoughts?
You're muted. We're only live.
I'm unmuted. I know where that is. Well, I've been using my space bar, but during the break, I ran outside quickly because, you know, we did this in two parts. If you didn't see the previous part, it's episode 114, and so you got to go back and listen to it. But during the break, I ran out of here real quickly because I read number five and took down all my cameras and threw all my guns in the trash because I didn't want crime to come to my neighborhood. And I know if I have stuff out there to stop crime, criminals will come, according to five. Okay, so we're at six. So I sort of make the same kind of argument for six. I've been hearing for years and years, if we have nuclear weapons, it's not a matter of if, but when. Well, when has a long history back to 1945, and guess what? No accidents, no nuclear wars. So what are we're afraid of ourselves all the time.
Are you telling me, Jim, that we've never had a weapon accidentally go off?
I'm telling you that we've had no nuclear yield, okay, from a nuclear weapon going off. We've had accidents. Oh, certainly. We've had.
But never when it resulted in detonation.
I didn't say that. No nuclear yield. Okay. People look up Bomark as my favorite. I know most people don't know about the Bomark incident at Fort Dix, New Jersey, I believe, or whatever that Air Force base is beside there. McCord, I think. McGuire, whatever it is. It's Air Force thing. Anyway, but it's next to Fort Dix. But we had Bomark missiles standing on the edge, waiting to be fired, filled with hydrazine, ready to be fired. And there was an accident, and hydrazine exploded, and nuclear material was thrown all about. But no nuclear yield. By the way, when those were sitting there in New Jersey, no one attacked New Jersey. Why not? True. We had some weapons there. They should have wanted to, you know, respond, right?
And Adam, didn't we have a weapon pop off in 1982 in Arkansas?
Yeah, I mean, this is the great thing about I kind of like our old nuclear weapon accidents because they highlight how good our safety systems are.
Our engineers are.
And so, you know, that Damascus, Arkansas, it's a Titan II,
right?
And we blow it up. We throw the warhead a half a mile, and it lands in the forest and nothing happens, and that's that. We've burned missiles. You know, we've had fires on B-52s. And
dropped them in the ocean.
We accidentally dropped them in, you know, North Carolina. I mean, we've done all kinds of stuff, and we've demonstrated, and this is with really old technology. Mm-hmm. Our safety systems now are much, much, much better. So
taking the other side of this, it kind of makes me wonder, will our systems really go off? I mean, we've got a number of issues where we've dropped them and they've never gone off. Does that affect credibility?
Let's move on to number seven, because I want to have time to talk about solutions.
Right.
And so, you know, fallacy number 7, arms control agreements will drive improved political relations. So the United States should seek agreements for the priority purpose of easing political hostilities. Again, mm-hmm. agreement details are far less important than achieving the agreement. Now, this is a big, you know, so the arms control industrial complex that advocates for arms control for the sake of arms control has made this point and has said that, you know, things always get better because arms control agreements bring people together. You understand each other's, you know, way of thinking and fears and aspirations and all that. But what we also know is that, because we've never had arms control with the Chinese, but we know that every single arms control agreement we've ever signed with the Russians, they violated. And we also know that they assume that because they were violating them, we were violating them too, because we would be crazy not to violate them, because it was good for them to violate them.
So they were mirror imaging on us.
They were mirror imaging us. We must be as bad as they are. Therefore, I'm not sure that you really get the desired effects, particularly with the Russians.
Yeah, I would also say, and remind people from our podcast from a few weeks ago on minimizing versus maximizing our nuclear deterrent, the Bahamas have never had an arms control treaty with Russia as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So let me comment on this real quick, because the problem here is there's an arms control ecosystem, right? People make money and they become professional negotiators and these sorts of things.
There's graduate programs that train you.
But they use the wrong metric. And the metric they use is how many agreements do we make, instead of the correct metric, which is how many agreements do we make that are good deals for America? Right. And that metric doesn't always count in these things when we're looking at this. And that is one of the real challenges here. And when you think about idealists and realists in the arms control vernacular, idealists are interested in the result. Realists are interested in the details. And that is part of the problem here, is that idealists don't want to let realist details get in the way of a deal. And realists don't want a deal if the details aren't worked out as they matter. Numbers, verification, and second and third order effects. If you gloss over those, you're going to get bad deals. Remember, the rule for any arms control treaty is first. At the end, all parties in the treaty still have to believe that their national security needs and their national interests are met, or they'll cheat. Second, there has to be bona fide verification measures with corrective actions, or there's no verification, then they'll cheat. And third, you can't have an asymmetric valuation of the treaty itself. In other words, we can't want it more than they do, because if that's the case, they will always take advantage of us. And so we have to have a situation where they are more interested in the treaty than we are. Because in the end, and we've talked about this before in previous podcasts, up till now, and I think if you read between the lines of this article with Dr. Payne, the one thing that Russian negotiators and American negotiators both agree on, and that is they both have an equal goal of disarming the United States.
Yes.
Curtis, your comment about idealist and realist, it just came to me during this podcast. I was thinking what another difference, because I've heard Keith Payne and you and everyone talk about it. I've learned a lot about that. But I have a new view on that. A realist, okay, looks at what did happen. An idealist thinks of what woulda, shoulda, coulda happened. And you see that in our previous argument about weapons. Oh, if we have to keep weapons, we're going to have these accidents and nuclear wars. They didn't happen in the past.
Right.
Why do we think it's going to happen in the future? What's changing all of a sudden?
Now, I'm not saying it's aspirational.
That's right.
Right.
Nuclear accidents are aspirational because if you have them, if you have them, then you can make a stronger claim to eliminate the weapons. So it's an aspirational goal to have.
In a nuclear disarmament mind, we're one good accident away from disarming.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, that's why you keep saying they're going to happen. Okay, so point number eight, and then we'll get to the recommendations.
Right.
Point number eight, nuclear weapons are essentially useless instruments. And if Washington reduces the role of these useless weapons, Russia and China will follow suit. Correspondingly, anti-nuclear activists must press Western leaders to reject nuclear weapons. This is the path to global nuclear disarmament. So,
how does something useless have a role? I'm just curious. But anyway, that was when I read this, I couldn't get through that piece. And then the other piece when I read this is Western leaders should reject. I thought it said eject nuclear weapons, which I thought was an interesting way to read that. But I'll let Curtis respond a little more seriously.
Well, it's easy to petition and protest Western democracies because they encourage and allow it and accept it, if you will. And the autocracies won't, right? So the low-hanging fruit says we go and disarm the Western nations first, and then hopefully the autocratic nations will follow suit. The problem is autocratic nations aren't interested in benevolence. They are interested in power. They are realist nations. And when you balance power and your adversary unilaterally disarms, that's probably pretty good news to you in that regard.
I've never quite understood, and I've never gotten a good answer because I asked this, and that is, why do you want to make the world safe for great power wars again?
That's right.
Because
right.
We know what that we've seen that episode. We know what great power wars look like. We've got thousands of years of human history where great powers fight each other and eradicate each other. And, you know, this idea that it's not going to be that bad. And even if, let's suppose hypothetically, all nuclear weapons are gone today and the technology is forgotten. You know, the Soviet Union and the United States would have likely come to blows during, you know, what was the Cold War. That would have been a very ugly, costly, deadly war. Or if it's today and there's no nuclear weapons, the U.S. and China going to war would be a very costly, deadly war. And I'm not sure why so many people, especially because they think we spend too much on defense anyways. But yet you want to go back to a time when we were spending half of GDP on fighting major great power wars.
Yeah.
It just is illogical.
And also, I like to point out here, when we disarmed, after we removed whatever in the Cold War nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula, it didn't stop the North Koreans from nuking up.
Yeah.
Right? And so, in fact, their nuclear program started in 1994 and really came to fruition right in 2006. So we see that it's the exact opposite happens, and that this idea that if we lead, they will follow when it comes to disarmament just isn't the case. And history's proven that out.
Yeah. Okay.
I know you're going to get the solutions, but I want to set you up a little bit. And that is what options we have. So one, if we disarm and everyone else disarms, okay, that's one option. We disarm and our adversaries don't disarm, and now we become, you know, destroyed by our adversaries. Or we don't disarm and our adversaries don't disarm, and we maintain the peace as we have. Or they do disarm and we don't disarm, and as long as we're not the aggressor, which we can control, all is fine. So it seems like the two options of us not disarming are the best options. Now passing it on to you, Adam, talked about these resolutions.
Okay, so Keith offers sort of four what do we do now? And his first one is, you know, is with regard to strategic deterrence. Now, Curtis, I know that you wanted to take issue with some of his recommendations. So I'm going to let you, of course, kick us off. When it comes to strategic defense, his first option, what was it that you liked and disliked?
Oh, with the strategic defense?
Yeah.
The idea here, he says, Washington must get past the Cold War canards that strategic defenses are destabilizing and are of no value unless they are leak proof. And And to his credit, Dr. Payne goes on to say, you know, you can't rely on leak-proof defenses as an if-then scenario, right? So some measure of defense capability has a deterrent effect. We call that deterrence by denial. Denying the potential of success might force an adversary to decide that they're not going to take the risk. Going back to that question about mutual vulnerability, it was the United States that terminated the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972 in 2002. And so the idea that we must continue to have a mutual vulnerability kind of idea, we've kind of already eschewed that. We've said, no, we're going to have some limited ballistic missile defense. By the way, our adversaries have limited missile defense capability. And so while they cry crocodile tears and argue that it is America's missile defense system that has removed their ability to hold us at risk in a mutual vulnerability or mutual assured destruction scenario, they have as robust a missile defense capability as anybody else. So this is a real issue here. My problem with this, and we've talked about Iron Dome several podcasts ago, but to me, it's just it's going to be overwhelmingly expensive. And when it comes to nuclear weapons, I think offense always beats it out. We knew this back in the 60s when it was about 3-to-1 costs of the cost of defense to an offensive Soviet dollar spent. And that was expensive. So when we were thinking about budget issues and whatnot, it might be cheaper just to have a more robust threat than it would be to build a really robust shield.
Yeah. Okay, so for his second, you know, in regard to strategic strike forces, he says the proper pacing factor for deterrence is not to match the combined number of Russian and Chinese nuclear forces. A deterrence need is for sufficient, survivable, flexible, and controlled strategic retaliatory forces to reliably cover Russian, Chinese, North Korean, and potentially Iranian targets. Now, we disagree with that because we wrote sort of our own strategy.
This past summer, yes.
Yeah, and we took, you know, our whole premise was to reject this very, you call it strategic sufficiency.
Yeah. Well, we called ours dynamic parity. You can find that on our website at thinkdeterrence.com.
And so we said dynamic parity is what you actually need, and that is you essentially have to match one for one. And it, you do it. Can we potentially, in an idealistic situation, knock out, with one or two or four nuclear weapons, let's say, kill a dozen Russian bombers armed with 80, nuclear weapons? So therefore, 1-to-4 can kill 80. Is that possible?
If we go first,
yeah. In an idealistic world, it is possible, but. Like we've said before, in Iraq and Afghanistan, it took 250,000 rounds of small arms fire to kill one, Taliban or Al-Qaeda fighter. 250,000 rounds. So the idea that nuclear weapons, it's going to be, one weapon kills X number of targets and nothing ever goes wrong, nothing fails, nothing blows up in the silo.
The missile makes it. There's no interception.
No B-52 crashes. None of that happens. That is not realistic. So what do you need? Well, you need extras, just like you've needed in everything else, everywhere throughout history in war. You need extras. And those extras are what we call dynamic parity.
Right. And I want to take issue with the term strategic sufficiency, what Dr. Payne writes in here is sufficient for survival. And to me, this is a fairly subjective term. And what is sufficient may not be fearful. And for deterrence to work, the adversary needs to be afraid that you can rain intolerable destruction in retaliation. And if you're going to survive a first strike, you must have more,
yeah,
right, to strike back with. And again, if they're if the idea that they are collaborating together and that China is building hundreds of new missile silos, these are new targets that must be covered in a counter force strategy. You, by definition, need more. Now, maybe that's hidden in the ambiguous definition of survivable sufficiency, but in nuclear deterrence, I want more detail. I want to know what those numbers might be.
So we've got two final ones to cover in our last couple of minutes. So the first one, you know, is in regard to theater strike forces. And Keith says, a frequent quip is that for the target, there is no difference between strategic and theater nuclear weapons. Perhaps, but the difference is likely profound in terms of their credibility for extended deterrence. I'll let you make a quick comment there, Curtis.
With regard to, obviously, this is borrowing from Secretary of Defense Mattis's axiom that all weapons, all nuclear weapons are strategic no matter what their size is. I'm paraphrasing. Forgive me if I'm not totally accurate on the statement. But the bottom line here is our adversaries don't see it that way. They see tactical small nuclear weapons as bigger bombs and are usable. In a sense of that they are employable. And so the idea that we think that they think it the same way, that there's some nuclear taboo, I think, again, we are whistling past a graveyard here, assuming that they are going to adhere to this to these sorts of taboos. Even though Putin has to date, you never know what will happen tomorrow with regard to this. And so the idea here, when you think about the PNIs after the Cold War ended in 1992, President Bush executed the PNIs and basically eliminated all of the theater ballistic capabilities that the U.S. had out there. Those were left in place in order to sign the INF Treaty, right? So when the INF went away, it was the reliance on those weapons that maintained deterrence in Europe, for example. Then we wiped that away. And so you pretty much left it without any capability. And then the Russians didn't follow. And so now they enjoy a 10-to-1 advantage. And that's probably a lowball estimate.
Yeah. And then finally, you know, he addresses this idealistic worldview. And he says, you know, and I'm quoting him, if so, in accepting this worldview, Washington must move away from the common but demonstrably false expectation that arms control agreements will meaningfully ameliorate political hostilities. And he goes on and he says, essentially, that we have to reject the idealist worldview because we have three decades of experience and it has abjectly failed. It just has abjectly failed. So now, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we were able to get in, you know, we had two episodes. We covered, you know, all eight of the fallacies. We discussed this the failures of idealism. And I think Keith really kind of gets it. He makes a really important point. So this is one of, you know, Keith Payne's great pieces. And he's got, you know, he's got The Great American Gamble and he's got several other books that are, you know, classics in the field that I would encourage everybody to go out and read. So, Curtis, again, thanks for being here for the discussion. Jim, thanks to you as well. It's always good. And I'm glad we got particularly excited about this piece because it makes some really fundamental points that are important. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on the first part of this, you know, broader discussion and then coming back for the second one. Hopefully you listen to both and read the article for yourself. See if you think we sort of laid it out properly and if we were right in our assessment of it. And of course, hit us up on Global Security Review. You know, listen to our podcast. You know, we Deterrence Down Under, our Australian version. They're hitting a new stride. Real Space Strategy with Chris Stone. You know, that's going well, and he's got a lot of great topics to discuss about space. So make sure you listen to that podcast, and then you know, please attend. Get on our mailing list, and you'll get all the information about upcoming events.
So check us out on YouTube and Rumble.
Oh yeah, YouTube and Rumble, we're expanding. You know, we Curtis and I, maybe we're going to, we've got to do Scotch and strategy.
We do.
I think it's sort of like drunk history, but without the drunk part, you know. Well, we'll have to figure that out. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.